From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Thanksgiving, just days away, and we are here to help you set the table. We've got some very interesting tidbits for you. For example, many of the things that we eat every day were originally created for the U.S. Army.
In the book, at a certain point, I give a tour of the supermarket, and I remove any item that has a military influence or origin, and at the end, I estimate that the store would be half empty.
That's ahead. First, though, in the break room on Friday, our panel talked about whether or not the word racist is overused and has therefore lost its meaning.
There should be people that are not afraid to open their mouths. And when you have people that say, you know what, stop saying these words, stop doing this, stop doing that, that sounds a lot like someone patting me on the head and saying, you know what, Kalina, you don't really know what you're talking about. Okay, right. I live this.
So here are your first thoughts. Frequent break room guest Robbie Medwed tweets, I'm really sick of people saying we need to be nicer to racists and that we may offend them by pointing out their hate. Bob Bailey responds, lynching and beatings did occur, people. We must stand against bigotry or we will enable it. We love getting your thoughts, so let us know what they are. Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. There is a social theory that tries to help explain selfish behavior. It's called the tragedy of the commons. And here's an example of it. Some parents don't want to vaccinate their own kids. They think it might have adverse effects. That means herd immunity is compromised, and then some kids get really sick, and the result is often tragic. Tragedy of the commons suggests that individuals often behave in their own perceived self-interest when they would have been better off in the end cooperating with other people. Joshua Weitz teaches biological sciences at Georgia Tech, and his department has developed a method to combat this phenomenon. He joins me now. Hi, Josh.
Hi there. Good morning.
Also with us by Skype is Georgia State sociology professor Dan Pasciuti. Hi, Dan.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. And I guess we really have to start by making sure people understand what tragedy of the commons means. And Josh, you guys started with an example from Lake Lanier, at least in the report that I read. How does that explain this tragedy of the commons?
Sure. So about 2 years ago, we began thinking about how individual actions can have a cumulative effect that ultimately can be worse off for all. I was at a conference in a group that was specifically charged with discussing this concept of the tragedy of the commons. And I went back and began to think about my experiences in Georgia. As you know, about 10 years ago, we've had a series of droughts. And at the time, Governor Perdue, we had restrictions put in place. And then things got better. And then the restrictions were lifted. And we had another drought. And again, this year, we just a couple days ago had Governor Deal impose another series of level 2 restrictions.
Right.
And so one of the things that I began to think about was that there's this tendency for individuals to think, well, things are good now. And so we don't necessarily have to think about what the conditions will be when they're worse off. And so we may end up through a sort of series of let's say, unintentional events leading to a bad condition. The condition could be, for example, depletion of lake levels. It could be, let's say, the spread of an infectious disease. And we actually work on microbes, and microbes have social lives, too, and I'm happy to talk about that as well.
The social lives of microbes?
That's right. But the central concept of the tragedy of the commons is really that individuals acting out of their own self-interest, you think, well, that's going to make us all better off if I get to do exactly what I want to do. And it turns out that that's not necessarily the case, that you could end up having conditions where the environment degrades, even though you think that you're doing what's best for you.
So, Dan, does this also relate to things that are not environmentally or biologically related? And because we just had an election, I have to think about all the cases in which people say that people vote against their own interests, for example. Is that also a tragedy of the commons?
Potentially. I mean, but we also have to understand, the issue of the tragedy of the commons is this assumption that underlies it about the fact that people operate in their self-interest. And there's been a lot of pushback in a lot of literature in these things. The famous historian E.P. Thompson once wrote specifically to critique Hardin's concept of the tragedy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just one second so people can stay with us. You're talking about the ecologist Garrett Hardin, who first came up with this concept of tragedy of the commons, I think like half a century ago. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. So E.P. Thompson, the historian, actually critiqued this and said, look, you know, they said that commoners themselves were not without common sense. And we can go back to Adam Smith, the famous economist, who said, you know, nature formed man for society and endowed him with an original desire to please, an original aversion to offend his brethren. So this
I don't know if that's still true, Dan.
Well, that may be, but he was operating under assumption of, or, you know, they're both of these see that creation as something different. So while I agree, there certainly are tragedy of the commons in certain conditions, we could use as an example, if you're talking about non-nature, the example of Wikipedia. And, you know, Wikipedia was originally, attempted to do sort of the Britannica model, where it was going to hire people to create this commons of knowledge that you could access on the internet. And it basically failed utterly because people were not going to put in the effort to create this online encyclopedia, even when they were getting paid for it. However, at the point at which they turned it over to being something that was open access, so anyone could write about the material and anyone could write on any subject they wanted, and there was a commons where this could be discussed, and this creation of an intellectual commons, it exploded and became quite successful.
You were shaking your head a little there, Josh. Why?
Oh, I'm not sure if I was shaking my head, but certainly it's interesting to draw these comparisons between, let's say, social issues, institutional issues, which I think is what you were getting at,
yeah,
at the beginning of the question with respect to institutional commons. And Dan, I think, raises an important point that people do act out of their own self-interest, but there are lots of ways, and I think that's really one of the issues that we tried to raise. How do we change incentives, or how do incentives change by the fact that people make actions and then literally change the environment around them?
Okay, so this is where we get to it. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about what's called the tragedy of the commons. My guest, you're hearing the voice of Georgia Tech Professor Joshua Weitz and also Dan Pasciuti, who teaches sociology at Georgia State University. So this is where we get to what you guys have been working on and researching and just issued your report. And in some ways, it's groundbreaking because I don't know if we've really had a solution to the tragedy of the commons before this moment.
Well, I want to be a little bit cautious about saying anytime solution to the tragedy of the commons. Right, exactly. But certainly I'd say it's a step forward, and I'll tell you what we think the step forward is.
Okay.
So conventionally, the way that the tragedy of the commons unfolds is that individuals given incentives decide to take an action, and why don't they cooperate? Right. They'd
right.
all be better off, and no one would be harmed if they cooperated. But each person thinks about, what would you do? What would you do, Celeste? And you think, well, if you cheat, right, I'm better off cheating. And unless you think about me and say, well, if Joshua cheats, I'm better off cheating because otherwise I'm going to get, you know,
I'm going to get edged out.
Right, exactly. And so we both end up cheating. And by both cheating, we both do worse. What we thought, the convention of this theory is that if we keep cheating and cheating and cheating, eventually the environment will change. For example, you started the segment discussing rates of vaccination.
Right.
So if individual parents think the way we just described, and don't end up vaccinating their children, what happens? Then at some point we get below critical levels of herd immunity.
Which has already happened
That's
in some
right.
areas.
We've seen it in Marin County and in other places. And then there's a spread of an otherwise preventable childhood disease. And then when a parent thinks, what are my incentives? Because now that their actions cumulatively have literally changed the landscape of incentives, and they may now think that the environment is bad, it's time to vaccinate. And so that's the central concept of what we tried to propose, is that individual actions modify the environment and then over time modify the incentives. And so with those changing incentives, it's possible people start cooperating because they see the cost of not cooperating as being quite high.
Dan, what do you make of this? Because I read a blog by one woman who didn't change her mind on anti-vaxxing until her kids all got the measles and nearly died. Do you have to wait until there is a real personal cost before you can sort of combat this?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I certainly, you know, think what they're doing is very interesting in this context. What I wonder about, though, is how much of is do we put out as incentives when these things change versus how much is the imposition of social structures and social norms? So when we think of something like vaccinations in Marin County, how much of that is the response back of social norms establishing themselves from outside and you know, quite literally in some cases, you know, attacking individuals for not vaccinating their children because of the sort of social norms that have been put in place now over several decades about what is good for the entirety? And is that really an incentive, or is that it just there may be a lag time in terms of the pushback on these social norms? The other way I was sort of thinking about it, and one of the things I would love to sort of see how their model understands this, is the solarized Decatur to cab campaign that's currently going on in Atlanta these days.
You're talking about the public transportation?
No, there's a program in place in Decatur and DeKalb County where they're trying to get people to join up in mass to put solar
panels. Oh, right, the solar panels on.
And with the idea being that the incentives, there's no incentives going into to that process. Well, there are still federal incentives, but there's, you know, Georgia doesn't exactly have a lot of state incentives. But the incentives themselves are actually being created by the collective action. So the more people that engage in the campaign, the more the costs can be brought down because things can be bought in bulk. And so that is actually protecting the commons through collective action that creates its own incentives.
Well, that sounds like he's asking you directly a question. Josh, did you want to answer that?
I think it's a great point that you've raised, Dan. In the model, I mean, again, models are useful, even though they may not be perfect representations of reality. And I think you're bringing up a really important question, one of which, how do people have, in some sense, we might say a nonlinear feedback, or you might just say a collective feedback. Therefore, my action is worth more, even to myself, when others take that same action, right? And so that often leads to maybe some critical threshold that this...
Like carpooling.
That's right. It only works at a certain point or a certain number of people who buy into the system for that then to be something that could have a positive feedback. So I think those microscopic mechanisms, you might say the mechanisms by which we actually try to avert the tragedy of the commons, that's certainly one of them, right? Social norms are another. In all of these cases, I think the thing that we were trying to do, and I think that's a point that I was trying to get out, has to do with the long-term coupling. So how is it, we often think that our actions, well, I'm just one person. How is
right.
it, or even
that
five
comes
people.
With voting. My
that's
vote
right.
doesn't matter. I'm just one vote
that's
among
right.
millions.
If all of us think that way, right, we are in big trouble.
Yeah.
If 50% of people think that way, and that's actually
almost 50%
right,
did.
Correct. Then you might say we also could be in big trouble, irrespective of what your political views are. I think it's a failure of a system to only
have...
Yeah,
we have don't 50- get a representative government,
exactly.
quite literally.
Exactly. So so these questions of how do you, in some sense, the actions of individuals, when magnified, have a substantial effect on the system itself, and those can over time then lead to changes with, and that may be incentivizing social norms or changing incentives directly. So I think that there's not an incompatibility here of what you're saying, Dan. In fact, I mean, I think you're really raising the point of how do one implement this theory with respect
right.
to specific applications.
How do you take it off the page and into the...
That's right.
Well, we only have about a minute left, Dan, but how could we implement it? Let's say, for example, public transit, which I mentioned earlier. People often want to ride in their own car. They don't see the benefit of everybody investing in public transit. How then do you do things like that?
So, I mean, you know, from the standpoint of ours, I mean, this is, I mean, what you're talking about and what Professor Weiss is talking about is this creation of new norms and this and these ideas. And there's a lot of question about whether or not the problem isn't not necessarily common ownership, but open access, right?
Right.
And whether or not we can create systems where people understand that they have their own opportunity to engage with rather than, you know, I mean, so in the example, if we want to go back to Lake Lanier, right, the problem is that in some sense has a common ownership, but it doesn't necessarily have open access. People don't understand
right.
the consequences to their
okay,
actions.
Okay, we got 20 seconds left.
And so I'll put it back to Dr. Weitzman just in the sense of what he thinks in this problem. What are the incentives? How do incentives actually emerge in that process?
Right.
And I guess that's the big question. Georgia State Sociology Professor Dan Pasciuti and Joshua Weitz. He's a professor of biological sciences at Georgia Tech. Joshua was also the head researcher of this new study about the social theory known as Tragedy of the Commons. His findings were published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The United States has the lowest college completion rate in the developed world, and that's not an easy problem to fix. But what if schools knew early which students might drop out? A new report from the New America Foundation says at least 40% of schools try to gauge student performance by comparing past students to current ones. That's called predictive analytics. But how well does it work? Manuela Ikowo is a policy analyst with the nonprofit New America Foundation. Hi, Manuela.
Hello.
And also with us is Tim Rennick. He's Georgia State University's Vice Provost and Vice President for Enrollment, Management, and Student Success. And he runs GSU's Predictive Analytics Program. Hi there, Tim.
Hello.
Now, GSU uses a different program, I think, from any other school. Is that accurate?
It's customized specifically for the students at Georgia State. That's correct.
What's different?
Well, the students are different. Georgia State's a unique institution in many ways, lots of low-income first-generation students of color. And so we actually ran data on Georgia State students. We used 2.5 million Georgia State grades, 140,000 student records. And what we try to do is look in the historical data for decisions that students make, actions that they take that make them statistically more likely to drop out or flunk out. We identified over 800 different things.
800 different characteristics that might predict whether a student would drop out or
exactly.
not. And we're going to go into what happens when you find a student like that. But Manuela, these predictive analytics have not always been particularly accurate in the past. What goes wrong when you're comparing past student performances to current students?
So one of the things that could go wrong is thinking about the quality of the data and the quality of the predictive models. And so what happens is, in the case of these early alert systems that are used at Georgia State and across other at other universities across the country, is that they're only able to predict what happened in their historical data. And if the historical data isn't robust enough or hasn't captured all of the things that students might experience that might put them off track towards graduation or interfere in their studies, the predictive models wouldn't necessarily be able to foresee that. And then advisors and other support staff wouldn't be able to provide interventions or supports to help the students navigate those processes.
Tim, how did you avoid these problems that she's describing?
Well, if you actually look at the sorts of things that we're identifying, a lot of them are really just common sense delivered at scale in a way that we couldn't previously. We have 51,000 students at Georgia State. And so there are lots of mistakes that students can make, especially first-generation low-income students, without even realizing it, that we're now able to identify. Things like students signing up for the wrong course. They're a chemistry major, but they sign up for the lab sequence for non-majors. In the past, they would have been allowed to just go on, take the wrong course, and somebody might have noticed it 6 months after they finished the course. Now we're identifying it as soon as they register and getting them in the right class before the first day of courses. Or underperformance in a prerequisite course, a pre-med major who does poorly in a math course or early on in the course in a quiz. Now, instead of waiting till the end of the semester till they roll into a D or F, we're able to reach out to the student and get them tutoring help, supplemental instruction, and so forth while there's still time to make a difference.
So, Manuela, you know, one of the issues that other analysts have talked about is how individual, how complex is the each individual's problem, and that a university itself is a very complex system. There are failures that can happen all the way along the way, from registration to the first day of classes. But part of it is a student's background in and of itself. Can predictive analytics actually help when what you're dealing with is a student who may have financial trouble, who may have family issues going on?
Absolutely. Colleges collect data on students. So, for example, as soon as a student enrolls, you have information about what kind of high school they attended. You have information about their socioeconomic status. You have information about how they have performed in high school, so their high school grades, their GPA, their standardized test scores. And so at the very beginning, you have some indication on where the student fares, both financially in terms of their socioeconomic status, but also academically in terms of how they have fared previously. And so in that sense, predictive models can help if you can create a model that shows, well, how do students of these particular demographics and with these types of characteristics perform at this institution? You can intervene. You can provide support very early on before they start to experience some of these negative outcomes like dropping out or not attending classes or failing courses.
How expensive is it to do this, Tim? And by that I mean, let's say that a student, their issues are caused by transportation, right? Mm-hmm. Can the university step in? I mean, what do you do and how much does that cost?
Absolutely. Well, what we found is that these kind of interventions more than pay for themselves. They pay in human terms because many more students are graduating. We're graduating 1,700 more students every year than we were when we launched this program a little over 4 years ago. That's a huge payoff for the students and families enrolled at Georgia State. But more than that, it pays for itself financially, because the students who stay enrolled actually continue to pay tuition and fees to the institution. institution. So those 1,700 students who in the past would have dropped out now are being sustained 4 years to the point of graduation, and that helps to pay for the programs themselves. But to answer your point about what kind of resources are necessary, we have introduced all kinds of additional support systems because of the information coming out of these analytics. You can't bring a student in and say you're at risk for X or Y and then not have some kind of solution to offer the student. So one of the things we've done is introduce Panther Retention Grants. This is a microgrant program. We've given 7,000 of these grants out over the 4 years since we've launched the analytics program. And what these grants do is help students in the kind of situations you're talking about. They may be short a few hundred dollars in being able to cover their tuition and fees or have some other kind of gap. And we're able to very nimbly and quickly give them the money, fill their account up so that they can stay enrolled and progress towards their degree.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about predictive analytics, how a school can determine which students, a university or a college, might struggle and how they might increase graduation rates. If you have thoughts on this, you can tweet us at OST Talk or join on Facebook. My guests are, you just heard Tim Renick of Georgia State University and also Manuela Ikowo of the New America Foundation. Manuela, okay, maybe I've seen too many movies, but as soon as somebody starts talking about predictive analytics, I think of Minority Report and think, wait, what if schools take this a step further and start accepting or not accepting students based on who they think might graduate? What are the dangers of these kind of predictions?
Absolutely. So one of the dangers that we're really particularly concerned about is the potential to label and discriminate against certain students. So students who are typically historically underrepresented at colleges and universities. So low-income students, students of color, students who are first in their families to attend college. And so in our report, what we basically said is that students, college administrators, and faculty should really make sure that these predictive analytics and this data doesn't close off futures for certain students, particularly students who are underrepresented. And they shouldn't also enable profiling of these students as well, who are traditionally at risk. So if these students have demographics or characteristics that are typical of at-risk students, how do we ensure that those who are interacting with students and helping to make sure that they have a seamless transition to the university, that they're not being pigeonholed or added labels are added to them that are negative, that only perpetuate some of these negative experiences that we want to try to ensure that they don't have. And we want to also make sure that these predictive analytics that are used in the enrollment process, so not only to help students once they're on campus, but to figure out which students to even accept, aren't shutting out certain students because of these predictive data.
How do you protect against that at GSU?
Well, absolutely. These sorts of data points are not used as part of the acceptance process. We do not use this in order to determine who's accepted or not. But let's look at the flip side of it. Georgia State this past year, by federal standards data collecting, was the only public university in the U.S. at which the Black, the Latino, the first generation, and the low-income students all graduated at or above the rate of the student body overall. We're also now...
I have to stop for a moment because that is a ridiculously amazing achievement. That's phenomenal.
And we're now the college or university in the U.S. that graduates the most African-Americans with bachelor's degrees. And both of these accomplishments came after launching this large-scale use of predictive analytics. I mean, to give you a sense of the scale, last 12 months we've had 51,000 one-on-one meetings with students to talk about information coming out of this system. And that's what happens. These are interventions that don't force the students' hands, but rather provide information to students that in the past they were lacking. I think that's exactly why we've been able to close these so-called achievement gaps. Because in the past, if you were a first-generation, low-income student, and you'd make a mistake, or you'd have a problem, you were struggling in your math class and you were a pre-med student, there was nobody waking up and saying, look, you might want to get this help. Now you need some assistance. There's an invisible support system that goes to middle-class students, to multi-generational college students. They have brothers and sisters and parents who are kind of looking over their shoulder saying, oh, you're not doing so well. Maybe you better reach out to help. And what we're doing with these predictive analytics is just that, reaching out at scale. I can't say we solved all 51,000 problems, but I can say 4 years ago, most of these 51,000 problems were going completely undiagnosed, and the students weren't even realizing there was an issue that might need to be addressed.
Manuela, can this be implemented nationwide, or are there obstacles at other schools that are unique?
I think that the popularity is increasing. And so what we found is that less than half of universities across the U.S. are using predictive analytics for any reason. So they're also being used to like predict how many people from alumni are going to donate to the university. So it's still in its relatively new and infant stage, but the popularity is increasing, and because of the successes at Georgia State, many people, other universities are also trying to figure out, well, how can we better support our students as well? And so I don't know if there will be a national model, but what I do expect to see is more institutions trying to figure out how can they create these models either on their own or partnering with other companies that provide these services so that they can see the kind of change that Georgia State has seen, which is really, really impressive.
Tim, I want to put to you this comment from a listener who writes, quote, our failure rate is high. I assume he's talking about in the U.S., but we are letting people into college who would not make the grade overseas. Do you feel that's part of our problem with graduation rates here in the U.S., that we're enrolling people who might not be ready for college?
I actually don't. I mean, I think it's easy to blame public school systems and K-12 and say if only they produced better mathematicians and students with better verbal and communication skills, then we'd have more college success rates. But what we've tried to do at Georgia State is really put the mirror on ourselves and say, what are we doing to trip up students? And what we found is a lot of students, even those who are underprepared by traditional standards, can succeed in college. They can get through. They can even get through very difficult majors. Every year since we've launched these predictive analytics, we've increased the number of minority students who are graduating in STEM fields. So part of the onus is on ourselves to say, we've created these really complex bureaucracies in American universities. How can we help students navigate the systems that we've created?
Well, let me put that to you, Manuela. Do you have any thoughts on what causes the low graduation rates at colleges and universities in the U.S. compared with our partners overseas?
So I kind of would echo what Tim has already said, that, you know, the college application process is a pretty complex process, so just getting into college is hard. And then once students get there, especially for students who are underrepresented, so they're the first in their families to attend these kinds of universities or attend college at all. And so they're largely flying blindly. And so the systems that we currently have in place haven't been very supportive to help students navigate and be successful once they're there. But I also do think that our K-12 system and our preparation systems to prepare students for college, especially students from certain demographics, so such as students of color and students or attending low resource schools, have more of a challenge to prepare these students to be successful once they attend the university level. So it does. There are issues start at the very beginning, and then there's a lack of support once students are there, which can be bridged.
So we have another question for you, Tim. This is from Michael, who says, this is awesome. What vendor do they use for their analytics?
Absolutely. Well, we have a large team of data specialists in-house. In fact, we've hired them up over the last few years. And we also partner with a large company in Washington, D.C. called the Education Advisory Board that does educational research and data processing.
Manuela, we have a couple minutes left, and one of the biggest issues that we've seen that has risen in recent years is the amount of depression reported by college students. Can predictive analytics actually help colleges or universities deal with mental health issues?
Good question. So in our research, we haven't found colleges using students' health records because that data is quite sensitive to do predictive analytics or to make predictions about what students might be experiencing depression or other mental health issues. But there is a growing popularity of using technology to deliver mental health services to students. So they're using video, they're using these online tools and apps that college students can use to try to figure out, you know, what's going on, get some additional counseling, especially if the college themselves don't have enough staff to support the need of mental health services. So
we have about
that's on the horizon.
We have about a minute left. Tim, did you want to address that as well as dealing with mental health issues?
Well, I will say this, that one of the features of the system that we use has an early alert where 2-3 weeks into the semester, professors can identify flag students who have behavioral issues or are just not attending classes. And sometimes those result flags result in meetings that create referrals to our mental health counselors and so forth. So it's one stab at beginning to get that outreach there to the students at an earlier time.
Well, it sounds like there may be more steps to go. I've been speaking with Tim Renick. He's Georgia State University's Vice Provost and Vice President for Enrollment Management and Student Success, and also from the New America Foundation, Policy Analyst Manuela Ikuo. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's common practice in this country to take a moment at Thanksgiving dinner and mention one thing you're grateful for. This year, might I suggest, the military.
Army food is no longer a matter of beans and guesswork. Since the last war, nutrition has become a science, and our Army Quartermaster Corps uses that science in planning Army meals. Food correctly used means fighting strength for our soldiers and better health for civilians.
That's a newsreel from the 1940s. Did you know many things we eat today were actually first developed for soldiers? That influence is especially apparent in Southern cuisine. Food writer Anastasia Marx de Salcedo is the author of Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. I spoke with her last year, along with Matthew Rayford. He's a farmer in Brunswick, Georgia. And I began the conversation with an anecdote about how I spent a number of years with a military supply officer who used to bring home sea rations, and they do not taste very good. Matthew's also an Army veteran, and here's what he had to say.
Well, they're just supposed to keep you going.
Well, that brings us to you, Anastasia. The impetus for this, I mean, what was the first food that you found had its roots in the military that kind of sparked your interest?
Oh, well, I have a little story about that, which is I'm a mom, and I pack a lot of lunches. And so one day, as I was putting together my daughter's school lunches, I got to thinking about the foods in them. You know, I had what I considered to be the healthy things, a sandwich, some carrot sticks and some grapes, and then the little less but healthy but child-pleasing things like the energy bar, a juice pouch, and some goldfish. And I started getting to thinking about the ingredients in the sandwich, and I said, these really probably aren't fresher or healthier than the things in packages. And then I started to do research on how the long shelf life was achieved for each of the items, each of the ingredients in the sandwich. And I found this reference to this obscure U.S. Army base, the Natick Soldier System Center. And I started to research on the Natick Center, and I found that it had been very deeply involved in 20th century processed foods and now in the 21st.
So, if you don't like processed foods, I guess you can blame the military, but they're also the reason why things last longer, right? I mean, why we have certain meats and cheese that can keep for some time.
Exactly, because for the Army, their goal is to create a combat ration, and it has certain requirements. The first is that it needs to be imperishable. It has to actually last for up to 3 years at 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Has to be rugged because it gets dropped out of helicopters and stuffed into backpacks, and has to be affordable because it's Uncle Sam's dime, and it has to be broadly palatable. So all those values are what the Army looks for in the food science that goes into combat rations, and then it actually has a mandate to get that food science into consumer items.
So we're going to talk about some of the specific foods that you're talking about here. But Matthew, let me go to you as well, because you were in the military. What did you like, Matthew? What was your particular thing that you were always trading to get?
Well, I was that peaches and cream guy. I like peach cobbler, you know. So the closest I could get to it was to kind of add the peaches with the creamer from the coffee and whatever crackers I could, and put it in, and as I hydrate it, it would become kind of like this mushy cobbler taste with the sugar packet.
You're talking about the powdered creamer, right?
Yes, the powdered creamer, yeah.
Oh, that does not sound appetizing, but Anastasia, let me go back to you. Give us some examples of some foods that were first developed for the military and are now part of our everyday diet.
Oh, there are. I actually, in the book, at a certain point, I give a tour of the supermarket and I remove any item that has a military influence or origin. And at the end, I estimate that the store would be half empty.
Wow.
So it's pretty broad. I mean, you can start even in the produce section where those packaged greens and salads that you get are kept fresh using something called modified atmosphere packaging, which was developed to send produce to Vietnam. You can move on into the meat section where the Army actually was the first entity to cut meat off the bone at the point of slaughter and box it up. And then that actually happened in the First and Second World Wars. And then, you know, 40 years later, the Army developed a new form of animal protein, which is something called restructured meat. And those are basically the cheaper bits of meat stuck together with meat glue. And that became a staple in fast food restaurants. It's what the McRib is, and has also infiltrated the supermarket in the freezer section and the refrigerated section.
And Cheetos has a military grade, literally a military grade powder on it, right?
Yeah, the Cheeto is coated with cheese powder, and dehydrated cheese powder was developed during World War II because they were trying to reduce the weight and volume of food shipped overseas. They pretty much dehydrated everything, and when they got to cheese, because cheese doesn't have an internal structure, it just collapsed and turned into a powder. After the war, the little industry that had sprung up to create this dehydrated cheese powder then turned to the grocery manufacturers, and they soon began to manufacture convenience foods and snack items such as the Cheeto.
Or is that the same as the powder that's in Kraft macaroni and cheese?
I think it is.
I would think so. So, Matthew, you actually took one of the things you learned from military food, and that was meat preservation, did you not?
Yes. So the MAP process that Anastasia was just talking about is one of the ways that we actually do some of our food here with sous vide. So basically what we do is we take those items, we season them, and then we put them in a machine that actually vacuum seals the bag. Then we take that bag and drop it down into water, depending on what the degrees that we're trying to cook the item in, and cook it that way. And then when we're getting ready to actually do the service, we take that item out of that package, sear it off, and then serve it.
I mean, I find it interesting, Matthew, that you have referred to the ways in which you've become a more creative cook because of having been in the military.
Right, because there was always improvise, adapt, and overcome. That was always, I mean, that's one of the service mottos, right? So, you know, this is what you have. This is all the space you have to work it in. I think Anastasia just talked about the fact of, you know, they couldn't ship all of this food because of the weight. So how do we dehydrate it? How do we make it smaller? So,
yeah, pull the moisture out.
Yeah, you know.
Well, I mean, I know I was engaged to a man who he used to do his cooking on the back of his tank because the exhaust is so hot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've done it many a times. I have warmed up beef stew that was inside and warmed it up off the back of the Bradley.
That's actually an excellent point, because the military really has been the source of many food science innovations during the 20th century. And we can talk about things like freeze drying, so that gives you your coffee, food irradiation, which consumers didn't really like, but is used now routinely on spices and herbs. Something called intermediate moisture foods, which are kind of had all those soft and chewy bakery items that we eat. And right on up to the turn of the 21st century, when the military, working with a consortium of big companies, developed something called high pressure processing. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Matt, where you use all this pressure to kill the microbes inside food.
Microbes inside.
And that's got, and that is, people now buy as the refrigerated guacamole you can get at the supermarket, those single portion juices and smoothies, and many deli meat items.
So another thing that you mentioned, talk about in your book, and you kind of go into detail about it, is the development of active dry yeast, which I cannot imagine how people baked before they had that. How did this come about?
Yeah, that's actually a great story. And it was one of the things I was going to sort of mention for your listeners is there's actually a lot of items that we home cooks use that come from the military, and active dry yeast is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Until the World War II, yeast had to be fresh, and because yeast is a live organism, and it was sold in moist compressed cakes that had to be refrigerated, and they only lasted for up to 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the Army actually had a special unit of bakers who prepared bread in overseas camps, and it was very difficult to obtain local yeast. So the Quartermaster Corps
began to research because they couldn't ship it.
Right, exactly. So they began to research how to preserve, basically to put yeast into a state of suspended animation. And they figured out a way that that involved a very long, slow drying that didn't stress the yeast organisms too much. And then they were able to rehydrate them months later and turn them into bread.
It's like they're putting the yeast to sleep because they can't kill it or it won't work.
Right.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
But Matthew, to a certain extent, all these things that she's talking about are kind of the opposite of what you do now with your life. They're talking about how to keep food and make it last, and you're all about fresh food.
Well, you know, how about this, though? Part of having fresh food, right, is having it seasonally. And how do you eat a tomato in the middle of winter? Well, what do? You make marinara. You make stewed tomatoes. And what do? You do canning. So preservation of food and preserving food is still a part of eating fresh food.
So and may I jump in and add that canning actually came about during the time of Napoleon.
Right.
And has a military
backing,
origin.
Right. I mean,
yes,
it's just like salt, right? You know, I think the term is you're not worth your salt. And one of the things that were given out, I think, if I remember correctly, were to Roman warriors were salt so they could preserve their food so they could go further and travel further, right? Because, you know, long distances and going through places that you've never been before, you'd have to have some sort of food with you, right? So one of the ways that you were given rations was you were given rations of salt so that you could dry your food. So, I mean, there's a lot of food things that we have been doing forever that come out of that, you know, conquering warrior type of movement.
You know, another thing I found really fascinating about your book, Anastasia, is how many people can now be cooks because of the military. And the reason I say that is because there's a number of things that have made cooking quicker and more easy. Otherwise, those of us who work a lot of hours, I would never have the time to go home and cook were it not for some of the developments they made in rice, for example, and many of the other things, the way that they preserved certain spices and herbs. Tell me a little bit about what kind of research the military did with rice.
The addition that the military made to rice was to industrialize the parboiled rice, which is actually an old Indian technique where you steam the rice and the nutrients actually get embedded in it. And that ended up being turned into a product, which is converted rice, and again was widely used during World War II.
And, you know, Anastasia, you also talk about the fact that they now, or have for the past 30 years or so, included Tabasco sauce.
Correct. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a Southern product.
Yes.
And that has actually entered the ration with the MRE, I think, in 1981, and at first was served in a little tiny bottle, which soldiers often brought back with them as sort of a memento. They've moved now to a little pouch. But that is definitely one way that soldiers can spice up their meals. But I was also going to add in to what Matt said, that one of the things that the Army has done has been to broaden the type of offering it has for entrees with the MRE to meet some of the changing demographics of the United States. So you have a lot more Mexican items, you have halal items, you have kosher items, you have vegetarian items, and so forth. So things are getting a little bit more interesting, too.
halal is a food that conforms to the Islamic faith.
Yes.
I wonder what they're, some of the things that the Army is working on now is they're trying to get a little fresher. What are some of the interesting developments going on in the military now with food?
Well, one of the things that I think is going to happen is, you know, what the influence that the military had on processed foods after World War II, there was this core set of values that I mentioned, that they be imperishable, durable, affordable, and appeal to this broad range of palates. As you know, time has gone on, we've become much more aware of some of the health impacts of eating foods that have, to achieve those things, a lot of chemical preservatives or additional ingredients such as stabilizers, emulsifiers, and thickeners, which aren't really good for us. And so the Army, to its credit, is also moving in the same direction as consumers in seeking more healthful food. And it's, you know, it's worked to eliminate trans fats, reduce salt and sugar, and looking for ways to create a fresher and more nutritious product, even doing such things as sort of encapsulating, which is, or microencapsulation of protein and other things, so that those things stay fresh, even if a food is stored for 3 years.
Okay, so Matthew, before we go, there is one thing out of the Sea Rats I kind of miss. They had these little circular chocolates with crispy rice in them that I still to this day kind of crave. And I'm wondering if there is anything from your MREs that you would eat again if you could.
You know, funny you say that. I always liked the beans that were in there.
Were they were refried or?
No, they were like these like baked beans, and I would actually use the hot sauce that she was just talking about. I love those beans.
Okay, so all you need to do is go out, grab a military person, Matthew, steal his beans or her beans, and throw some Tabasco on there. I've been speaking with Matthew Rayford. He runs a farm in Brunswick, Georgia, and also Anastasia Marx-Salcedo. She's the author of Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our show for today. And we want to hear from you as you start prepping for Thanksgiving. What is the most popular dish on your table? Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. Tweet us at OST Talk or post your response to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. And if you're going to post on social media, take a picture of the food, send it to us. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.